Tonight, we subtitled this Changed by the Fire. I like my sort of double entendre is the wrong way to say that, but this could have two meanings, all based on whether or not there's punctuation, technically, that we are changed by the fire, that when we encounter that fire, we are not the same after the encounter. That would be the case in real fire or spiritual fire. Or you could put a comma behind changed and you get a little bit of a different connotation. Peter's going to stand next to a charcoal fire tonight at the trial, arrest and trial of Jesus. And changed, comma, by the fire would denote that something happens while standing next to that fire. And what we know of the story, just top of our head without reading any text, is that this is a dark moment for Peter. And it is. There's no doubt about it. But thanks to John's gospel, and we happen to be studying John's gospel, thanks to John's gospel, we don't leave Peter in the dark. We don't leave him in that agonizing moment by that fire. We do get to pick him up later. So tonight's going to require us to do some split narrative stuff. And that's one of those evenings where John does part of that work for us in the 18th chapter, where John's going to start to tell a story, and then John's going to drift to a peripheral character. In this case, Peter. He's peripheral to the main event. The main event is Jesus is on trial, so anything outside of that's peripheral. He's going to drift to the peripheral character, and then he's going to drift the narrative back to the main event, and then he's going to drift to the peripheral character. And then he's going to drift back to the main event. It's an odd form for John. He hasn't done this kind of writing to us in the 18 chapters we've been with him. It reads a little more like a movie script. Scene, side character. Scene, side character. So we're going to play this little back and forth in John 18 between the narrative of Jesus in the trial, Peter standing by the fire, and then back and then back. But then we'll have to leave that moment to really finish the story, because I don't want to wait the months it's going to take me to get to John 21 to, and let's be honest, that's what it's going to take to get to John 21. I don't want to put that kind of a pause on our story and let Peter just kind of hang out there for months. So we're going to jump the narrative a few chapters to pull Peter's story into its completion tonight, so we'll watch John do that, swing the camera back and forth. But we'll also do it with him. We'll jump several chapters ahead. Now, what happens when we do that, inevitably, is that when I get to that point in three chapters or four chapters, is that there's other things to add, and there's things that we won't have to say because we said them now. Part of that's going to happen to us tonight, because I went back and looked at my notes, and way back in April, we were doing a lesson called When the Rooster Crows, and we did that because we were in John 13, where Jesus prophesied that Peter would deny him three times before the rooster crowed. Well, tonight our rooster crows. And I don't want to reteach that lesson, but here we are needing a refresher on the prophecy from John 13. So we're going to pull from the past. So tonight's one of those unique lessons where you get the lesson itself, but you get elements of the prophecy, you get elements of the fulfillment of it. So you kind of got to move around a little bit in that gospel. And we have the freedom to do that in our own personal study too. Hopefully that's how you read, is you're not entirely linear. So hopefully you're not just moving left to right in some breakneck pattern towards the end of a book, but you're allowing the Spirit to drift you to the left and to the right of the text to go and find what you know you read yesterday or the day before. That we have this incredibly self-annotated book that we call the Bible, this cross-reference machine that if you just get minimal amount of money and buy a center column reference Bible, you have this internal crossover that you can go crazy with Bible study. It's one of my favorite things is to read a verse and then go to the center column reference and look at all the pop, pop, pop. You got like four verses you can go run and go run them all. And some of them go sometimes nowhere. Sometimes I even put question marks in my center column reference going and circle a verse, like figure out why they put this here. This has to be an error. That really drives me nuts, by the way. If I'm center column referencing and I go to one that doesn't apply, I think, oh, there's somebody smarter than me. They put that in there for a reason. I got to figure out why. And I've went down some rabbit holes working on those ribs and column reference before. It's like, I don't think that verse was supposed to be referenced, but maybe it was. And I got to figure out why now. And that's sometimes that's not good. So really, I encourage you, follow the Spirit as you follow the center column reference. You don't get too lost in the middle of that. So I want to talk about change by the fire. I specifically want to talk about it in terms of Peter, but we're going to add another New Testament character in there as well and take a look at fire as a motif throughout the scriptures. And in doing so, let's start with just three verses from John chapter 18, beginning at verse 12. And I want to take you at the beginning tonight. We need to go into the trial for just not the trial, rather. I'm sorry. The beginning of the interrogation of Jesus. The arrest happens at Gethsemane. And this is the beginning of that. And then we'll move away from it. The detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. This is clunky in the English. We do not have the advantage in the Greek of having commas, question marks, exclamation points, periods. Most of the time we're guessing in translation. But the reason I say this is clunky is because we kind of jam it all together here. We've got the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews. But the reading of that would not make sense in the Greek. It wouldn't make sense in the context of the Roman world for it to read that way, because technically in the Roman world you would have had a detachment of troops who had a captain. So you could put a big old comma there, maybe semicolon, and the officers of the Jews. These are two different people. This is two different sets of people, okay? And I say this because I want you to realize the representation in the garden is not just a captain with a detachment of troops that all came from the temple. That doesn't make sense. The Romans are not employed by the temple to go to the garden to arrest. They're not cohorts of the Jewish temple. They could be employed by the temple, almost in a mercenary role, but they're not. They don't. Their headquarters is not the temple. All right, that would have been a desecration of the temple for Roman soldiers to set themselves up within the temple. And so you're really dealing with two sets here. You're dealing with the detachment of troops who are led by a captain. This denotes Roman. And then you're dealing with officers of the temple. This denotes those who are hired out by the temple to come and arrest Jesus. So there is a bit of crossover going on here. So we have more than just the high priest that has sold out. Judas has sold out Jesus to the high priest. We have that the Romans are involved in the arrest from the earliest inception. The reason I point this out is because the decision to crucify Jesus does not happen in the middle of the night. Like 3-4 o'clock in the morning after we've talked to Jesus for 3 or 4 hours, we go, we should crucify him. The only reason they send Roman soldiers out there in the first place is because the intent was to have the Romans crucify him from the beginning of the trial. And so this is the crucifixion idea is not an afterthought. I bring that out because Judaism does allow for capital punishment for blasphemy, but Judaism does not have the legal authority in the first century to mandate that capital punishment without the authority of Rome. And a caveat is that in Torah, specifically in Deuteronomy, a man that hangs on a tree is cursed by God. The Romans have a very effective way of hanging people on trees called crucifixion. The Jews have no such method of execution because they wouldn't dare curse a man by God when they killed him. They could stone him, but they wouldn't hang him on a tree because that would be to curse him by God. And so the fact that there's a detachment, a captain, comma, and the temple guards means that we've already got the idea. Let's get the Romans involved because they can put him on a tree. And if they put him on a tree, he's cursed of God. And that's how we pitch this to the crowd. And so the early church is dealing with that for a generation. You mean you people follow a man you think is Messiah that was cursed by God? Paul deftly handles that in Galatians 3. Remember when Paul says, "For as it is written, cursed is a man that hangs on a tree, so Christ became the curse to redeem us from the curse of the law." So Paul takes it and goes, sure, he was cursed. Let me show you how. And so that's a pretty impressive handling of that event by the Apostle Paul. Okay, I spent more time on that than I intended to, but it's a good place to kind of throw in the reality of what's going on in terms of both the Jews and the Romans being involved. They arrest Jesus and they bound him, verse 13. And they led him away to Annas first. He's the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Keep that in mind. I think this is a bigger deal than, personally, I think this is a bigger deal than a lot of other Bible scholars give it credit for. I'll tell you why in a second. It's a big deal that he goes, that mentions Annas as the father-in-law of the high priest Caiaphas. Now, it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And that happens, remember, at the end of the Lazarus story. When Lazarus raises from the dead and Caiaphas goes, we can't leave him alone. If we leave him alone like this, everybody will believe in him. And then Caiaphas says, how about one man die for all of us? And although Caiaphas means it'd be better for us to shut this guy up than the Romans come take our nation away from us, John interprets it prophetically and says Caiaphas prophesied one man die for all of us. And so that's, for us, that's the gospel in Christianity, is one man died for all of us. But the interesting point here is that they go to Annas first. Some translations have him as Ananias. And that they speak to, and he's father-in-law to Caiaphas, formerly the high priest, not currently the high priest. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John all tell you that Jesus goes on trial. Only John tells you that they start at the house of Annas the high priest. Here's my theory. Annas had five sons. First century historian Josephus tells us this in his writings of the Wars of the Jews. And he writes a chronicle of the history of Israel, really from the first Herod, say, 13 BC. No, 13's not right. 35 BC, 37 BC. We're talking Antony and Cleopatra era. Josephus starts a history of the Jewish kings and he runs it through AD 70. And so a lot of what we know about AD 70 we learn from Josephus. Here's some other stuff we learned from Josephus. That Annas was a high priest that had five sons who served as high priest. Josephus tells us his first son served, his second son served, and then his son-in-law Caiaphas served. And then his third son served, and then his fourth son served, and then his fifth son served. So literally, Annas had five natural-born sons who served as high priest and one son-in-law who serves as high priest, Caiaphas. Only John includes his involvement. Nobody else even mentions him. The other Gospels have Jesus going straight to Herod or Caiaphas. John goes, no, he didn't go straight to Caiaphas. He went to Annas, the first high priest first. Now, why is that? Why does only John do that? I'm arguing from silence because I don't get to interview John and go, hey, John, why is it that you mentioned Annas? But we do have John sharing some stories that none of the other gospel writers share. And I think there could be more going on than meets the eye. Could it be that John is still trying to explain the reason for the anger attached to the resurrection of Lazarus? And if you'll recall, when we taught John 11 and John 12, and the resurrection of Lazarus so infuriated the chief priests. Why? They don't get mad when Jesus raises Jairus' 12-year-old daughter from the dead. They don't say a word. They don't get mad when Jesus touches the coffin in Nain and raises the widow's son from the dead. They don't get mad. But when he raises Lazarus from the dead, they go crazy. In fact, they try to kill Lazarus. They spend the 12th chapter of John with a bounty out on Lazarus' head. You go, why are they so mad that he raised a guy named Lazarus? And if you'll recall, my theory is that Jesus had indicted them as the rich man who doesn't take care of the poor man, and that they're in hell. Because he said there was a rich man who fared sumptuously every day, and he wore fine linen, and he had five brothers, and he had a dad, and he died. And I think Jesus was telling the story to the leadership of Israel. In your life, you take care of you. And you've ignored Lazarus. And Lazarus's Hebrew name was Eleazar. Eleazar was the servant of Abraham in the Abraham story. Just a poor dude. Where is Eleazar? Where's Lazarus in the story? Abraham's bosom. In his master's bosom. Not in heaven somewhere. It's not a story about heaven and hell. It's a story about why Israel isn't taking care of who they're supposed to take care of. You've stepped over him every day on your way to do your job. And now you suffer. And they got so infuriated, I think, over that story. Personally, I think that's why John throws Annas back into the story, is to remind you of this reason for the vehement anger in the Gospel of John over this incident, over this Jesus. So now let's take that narrative and just move with John. He swings the camera out of this. Jesus is at Annas' house, going to get questioned. And then we take the camera over and we leave the main scene. We go to a B scene, a side scene. It's the next verse in our story. And we'll have to swing away here in just a second. But let's go with John. Simon Peter, this is the very next verse. Simon Peter followed Jesus and so did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. Scholars have wondered and wondered for a long time, who's this other disciple? Consensus is it's the author of the book, who never names himself, by the way. John never, his name never appears in his own book. So when we talk about the disciple whom Jesus loved, the disciple leaning against Jesus' bosom, that other disciple, consensus is the author, John. And so John has some sort of connection to the high priest. In fact, in the book of Acts, when they name Caiaphas's family, there's a guy in the list named John. Does that mean it's John from John's? No, doesn't mean that, but our author is known to Caiaphas. That's what we know. Peter's not. And so there's going to be this awkward incident where two guys show up, one gets in, one doesn't get in, because one knows someone and the other one doesn't know someone. So the disciple was known to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. He goes basically into the front yard, which is inside the gate. But Peter stood at the door because nobody knows him. So Peter's not allowed in. So he walks up with the other disciple, but he's not allowed to come in. Then the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. He kind of comes out and uses his name and goes, "Hey, I know him. Can we let him in?" So I think this is an awkward moment for Peter at best. This is kind of this maybe a little bit uncomfortable moment. This is just setting the narrative, setting the scene. 17. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You're not also one of the man's disciples, are you?" And in the great contrast of literature, John's been the great I am guy. Jesus has been saying, "I am, I am, I am, I am." And John has Peter say, "I am not," in one of those amazing moments. John really hypes up. I'm safe in saying this because I know where we're going, but I think this is true. John really hypes the Peter story, the denial, even with the "I am not." It's such a contrast to the, remember the guy that keeps saying, "I am? Are you Jesus?" "I am." You know, and we just saw it in the garden. And then here's, "Are you with him?" And the same guy that was like, "I'll go with you. If they're going to kill you, they're going to kill me." And Jesus goes, "No, you're not even going to make it through the rooster crow and you're going to deny me." And so they go, "Are you one of his disciples?" Here's his first entrance into the courtyard. This is his first moment. He just got there. They're letting him in. "Are you one of his disciples?" "I am not one of his disciples." Verse 18. Now the servants and the officers who had made a fire of coals stood there because it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. Before we face the fire with Peter, and we're going to, let's just think about the fire motif through the Bible. Just like we did with the lamb last month when we did our first Silencing the Lamb message, and we talked about the biblical importance of the lamb and how it appears early in the story, and then the lamb progresses. It sort of weaves through the story, through the prophetic story, through the sacrificial story, through the Exodus story, through the prophetic story, through the John the Baptist story, all the way to this blossom explosion in Revelation. Fire has a very similar pattern in the Bible, strangely enough. And it's not one of those I ever really thought about as having a pattern until I began to think about this message and Peter standing next to that fire. Because this is a vital moment, because John uses a Greek phrase in his gospel that isn't used anywhere else in the Bible for charcoal fire. But he doesn't just do it once, he does it twice. He'll do it here and he'll do it later in the book. And when you see that happen, you might be dealing with an author who just has access to a Greek word nobody else uses. But when you see them use it twice within the same narrative, usually they're trying to do something. It's a little bit like, I am not. And so you get that phrase charcoal fire. And so that got me thinking about fire and the idea of fire in the Bible. And when you look at it, it's always been sort of considered to be the definitive turning point for man, is his harnessing of fire, is really what separated him from the jungle, from the animals, because he could take that thing that had such potential for disaster. I mean, fire destroys and it wipes out and it kills. But if harnessed, it puts man at the top of the food chain. I mean, it allows him to live in adverse environments. It allows him to harness bad weather. It allows him, it gives him reason to hunt the animal because he can cook it and eat it. He's not just dependent on agriculture. Now he becomes literally the king over the beasts of the field, not just because he can kill, but because he can cook. So fire becomes that thing. But the Bible uses the motif for a lot of ways. The first time we see it in the Bible is as judgment. It's that which falls from heaven to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. So it's God's justice against injustice. Because Sodom and Gomorrah's great sin was not sex. Sodom and Gomorrah's great sin was that they didn't know how to take care of the stranger in their community. And so God's fire becomes the purging. God's fire becomes justice against... It becomes vertical justice against horizontal injustice. That's the Bible's first usage of fire. And then the next biblical usage of fire is man tames it. Isaac and Abraham are going up the mountain. Dad, we have the wood. We have the knife. We have the fire. We're carrying our own fire. We're going to judge something the way God judged Sodom. And so fire becomes a tool of justice in the hands of men. But it also becomes, not just becomes, it also begins to reveal itself in the Bible as the means by which God speaks to man. Moses goes out into the backside of the desert and he sees a bush burning on the horizon, but he notices that it's not consumed. And to me, the only way you see something burn but not consumed is if there's no smoke that's accompanying the fire. Because you don't turn aside, by the way, to go see brush fires in the wilderness. I mean, we lived in California. Brush fires were common. You didn't get off the road and go check it out. Smoke's for miles. You know stuff's being consumed. But if you saw a fire with no smoke, now that's interesting. And Moses peels off to go see the bush that burns but is not consumed. And what does he see? God standing in the middle of the fire and beginning to speak out of that fire. And so fire becomes not just a vertical judgment or not just a horizontal sacrifice. Fire becomes revelation. Fire becomes where God stands. It becomes the voice of God. And the narrative of the Bible carries that on. What happens whenever three Hebrew boys refuse to bow down when the music is played to the idol in the book of Daniel? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Good old-fashioned Sunday school story. Remember those guys? True trivia question. What's their Hebrew names? Because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is not their Hebrew names. That's their Chaldean names. So chew on that one. You get brownie points at the end if you can come up with their Hebrew names without cheating. But they get thrown into the fire, and what happens? Not only are they not singed by the fire, their clothes don't smell like smoke. The Bible, which had God sitting in the middle of a fire in the wilderness, burning a bush that but is not consumed, speaking to Moses, here he is. There's a fourth man in the fire. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, looks down in and goes, I think I see a... How many guys did we throw in the fire? You know that famous moment? They go, we threw three. Well, why is it that I see four? And the fourth looks like the Son of God. He didn't say the fourth looks like Jesus, because that wouldn't have made any sense. But he does say the fourth isn't human. There's something in there that's beyond that room. And he's protecting those that are in there. And so in that fire becomes the very revelation of who God is. And then John the Baptist. I'm not the one, but there's one coming after me who's preferred before me, whose shoes I'm not worthy to unloose. I baptize you with water, but he shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, because he's going to have his fan in his hand and he is going to control a fire that is going to rage, and he's going to gather his chaff separate from his wheat, and he's going to store the wheat away and he's going to burn the chaff with an unquenchable fire. And so that fire motif is, it's vertical justice, it's sacrifice, it's the face of God, It's the hand of God. It's the justice system of heaven. And I think it's all relevant when Peter stands in front of that fire because of what's about to happen to him. And as you kind of grab that motif, think about this. Facing the fire, and I'm not talking about a charcoal fire. I'm talking about fire as an issue in the Word. Facing the fire is an inevitability in your life. It doesn't make us as much as it exposes us. And what I mean by that, there is a making that happens in the fire. We're going to talk about that. But when we face the issues of life, it is not, the first object is not to develop something in us. The first object is to expose whatever is in us that can burn up. This to me is a lost message in the message of grace, what I'm about to say to you. We need not forget that the fan is in Jesus' hand, right where the seven stars are in Revelation. The sword's not in his hand. The fan is in his hand. The seven churches are in his hand. So what's that telling me? The process of purging is not Jesus removing sin from our lives every day. I'm going to reach in there and grab that. Here's what you've been doing. You won't admit it. No. But you do have chaff. See, chaff isn't sin. Chaff's just stuff you can't eat. When you harvest the wheat, you got stalks. Nobody's mad about the stalks. You just don't make bread out of stalks. That's not a sin problem. It's just stuff in your life that slows you down. And the Holy Spirit is still burning that out of me. And he's still burning that out of you. And that's not a sin issue. That's you facing the fire. And it's inevitable that you face the fire. You'll face the fires of this world. You'll face the fires of life. You'll face the fires up here. You'll face the fires in the Spirit. Don't look at it as God's trying to teach me something, but do look at it as this is an opportunity for whatever needs to burn off to burn off. That there's some areas of my life I could do without. It's not productive. It's not productive for me. It's not productive for my spouse. It's not productive for my kids. It's not productive for my marriage. You can insert all the stuff all the stuff that matters to you right there. What matters to you matters to him, he who holds you in his hand. And so as he's burning off the chaff, this is the stuff that needs to go. So you're going to face it. And the reason I say the grace message needs to hear that is because I don't think we've given enough credence and credit to the burning power of the Holy Spirit. We've just said for so long, if the Holy Spirit's working on you, he's trying to remove sin. And I think we missed the cross and we missed the resurrection. But don't lay the fire down because we've now had a revelation of the cross and the resurrection. The fire's still there. The fire's not looking for sin, but it is burning off the chaff. This is the junk I don't need. And some of it's not even bad, but it's just the Holy Spirit going, you know, we don't need that. And some of it comes out of pain because I'm facing the fire. Some of it comes out of loss because I'm facing trials, persecutions, struggles. And I go, man, I feel like some of that junk's getting burned off my life. I really feel like I learned something through that. Hey, man, it's a whole heck of a lot better to face the fire and learn something than to face the fire and learn nothing. You face the fire and learn nothing, then you think you've been abandoned. Like, why God let me go through that? I didn't learn anything. All I know now is that I'm hurt and I got scars. I'm no better off for that. But that's not the way your Father works. He never waves the fan of the Spirit of fire in your life. He never lets you stand by the charcoal fire and leaves you and abandons you. So there's something to be done there. Peter has just been reprimanded for his actions in the garden. What was his actions in the garden? He pulls his sword. He cuts Malchus' servant's ear off. He's so reprimanded, Jesus heals the guy in front of him. Says, put your sword up. We don't do that. You want to live that way, you're going to die that way. What a hangdog look Peter has coming out of the garden. He's thinking, I don't know, what am I doing with my life? He gets to the courtyard. He's not even allowed in. I think this is a source of pretty pride-busting embarrassment by Peter, who finally just walks over, sticks his hand in front of the fire, and kind of wants to vanish beneath the carpet. The first person that goes, weren't you one of his disciples? I'm not. And so it's kind of piles on. And that's kind of what happens to us sometimes is it piles on in our lives. He's only invited in the courtyard as an afterthought. I think he feels shame and he feels embarrassment and he warms his hand by the fire looking for comfort on the outside while Jesus suffers on the inside. And I'm just doing what I think John's doing. I'm just trying to build the case that Peter's at a pretty rough spot. Peter's at that spot of denial that could have defined his life and ministry, if not for where this story is going to go, if not for what is going to happen. Now, we split the narrative. For tonight's purposes, we are not going to read verses 19 to 24. All right? We'll do that next week, because next week we'll focus on the trial, more on the trial. But in our story, remember, John's telling you one thing, and then he's telling you another thing, and then he's going to come back. We're not going to come back with him. We're going to stay over here, and we're going to deal with Peter, who's standing by that fire, because we can deal with the other when we get there. So I want to follow the narrative of Peter, not necessarily the chronological narrative of the text. To do that, we jump to verse 25 of chapter 18. Peter stood, and it's kind of interesting if you cut those other verses out, it's as if the story, nothing happened, you didn't miss anything. It's like, now Peter stood. So it just keeps right on rolling. Simon Peter stood and warmed himself, and therefore they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." That's the same phrase he uses to the woman. So now, piling up again, here's number two. Here comes the third. One of the servants of the high priest. Now, I want you to pay attention to this. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Didn't I see you in the garden with him?" Can you imagine this? So it was a stranger, and then it was a bunch of strangers, and now it's a relative of the guy you just assaulted in the garden. And so Peter's already went, No, I'm not him. What do you think he's going to say now? When a relative of the guy he physically assaulted in the garden confronts him, it's late at night, we're standing out in the cold. If you're standing out in the cold and it's late at night and you're warming yourself by the fire, you're probably drinking as well. There's some imbibing going on around the fire. There's some passions rising around the fire, all right? And so I think Peter is now confronted with an angry relative. I know I'm inserting my own adjective there. It doesn't say they were angry, but you gotta think, it's a relative. Why does John tell you it's a relative? He doesn't say some dude that knew Malchus. He says a relative, because you go looking for somebody that's out hurting your family members. And so a relative of the servant whose ear was cut off in the garden asks Peter, "Didn't I see you in the garden with him?" The guy was there. So he's a relative of Malchus, but he was in the garden. He didn't say, I heard you cut my cousin Bob's ear off. It's kind of doubtful he's Bob. That's slightly more slightly more British than it is. Okay, but he's in the garden, so he's probably visible. And, man, didn't that guy look familiar? I think that's the dude that pulled his sword and cut Malchus's servant. That's as good as Malchus, the high priest, cut Malchus's ear off. That we do know. And Peter's response? He denied him again. According to the other gospels, he cursed. This is right here. We don't know who he cursed, but he cursed. He verbally cries out. And then watch what John does. And reminder, this is 18, but if you've been reading this and you're just steadily working through this book, way back in chapter 13, Jesus had said to Peter, "Oh, you think you're ready to do what I'm going to do? I'm here to tell you, Peter. The rooster's going to crow. The rooster will not have crowed twice before you deny me three times." Now, if you'll recall in John's narrative, here's what happened. Jesus said, "The rooster will not have crowed until you've denied me three times. But let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." Remember, that was the very next verse. We don't get that because it's split. It's chapter 13, chapter 14. But it was all one sentence. So Jesus plants a seed in Peter. And the seed he plants is, "Oh, I know you feel good about yourself. You're not as good at this as you think you are. You're going to deny me, because I know your nature, Peter. But don't let your heart be troubled. Me and Dad are building a place for you. And we're going to build that place inside of you." So the seed of hope is already in Peter. And I think the seed of hope is already in us in our darkest night, because that's our Jesus. See, Christianity is not just the experience I had when I prayed a prayer and I got baptized and I accepted Jesus and I joined a church and I signed a membership card and I signed up to drive the church van and help with youth ministry. That's stuff. It's I receive this one who I know I'm going to still face a bunch of junk and I'm going to fall down and I'm going to scrape my knee spiritually and I'm going to have moments that are where I say I am not. But the seed of who I am has been planted so deep inside of my soul as a child of God, you too, that you have the equipment. This is what the message of grace really is. It's not, hey, no, there's not going to have any problems here. It's all good. It's really that no matter what, he doesn't leave you or forsake you. No matter what, he doesn't kick you out. No matter what, he's not done with you. He's planted something inside of you. He paid so much for you, he's not going to give up on you that easy. Like, I can't imagine a theology now. I can't imagine adhering to a theology now where it's so easy to lose my salvation when God paid so much for me to have it. I mean, he becomes a man and dies as me, raises from the dead. To lose me on some technicality or some mistake, impossible. He has implanted inside of us the equipment that we need in the middle of this moment. When that rooster crows in our life, immediately in that moment. Let's talk about that for just a second, and then I want to talk about that rooster. Confronted by an angry relative of the victim of Peter's assault, Peter backs down. Why does he back down? I wrote this in the margin of my Bible quite some time ago, this next sentence. A violent response is both unbecoming and indefensible as a citizen of the kingdom of God. Let me stay on that for just a second, because I think what happens is, I'm not entirely sure what Peter thought after his garden experience. Jesus goes, put your sword up. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. Permit even this. I don't know what he felt. But I know it all come rushing back to him when the relative of the guy whose ear he cut off gets in his face at a charcoal fire. Because that's when you really start paying attention. See, it's one thing to go out here in the world and respond secular. You'll rarely be called on that until you are. And that's when you perk up and pay attention. You know what I mean? Like, whenever you finally have moved so into the system of the world that the responses you're getting are just the secular response, and you realize the kingdom response has been left on the table, you didn't do anything with it. I think there's this moment here where Peter realizes violent response, and I want to hone in on that phrase because it's going to come back to that tonight. Violent response is indefensible. I'm a member of the kingdom. What I did in that garden was indefensible. And I got to learn that. And it took this relative getting in my face to call me on it. To where I realized, okay, I don't have a good way to defend what I did in that kingdom. And I think it's why sometimes it is good that we have to face off with this world as citizens of the kingdom. Because by facing off with them, we realize where our responses are less than godly, and what they should look like. His denial of Jesus is the exposure of his heart. In spite of his language, he's not ready to drink the cup. Remember, his language was pretty cocky. I'm ready. You gonna go? They're gonna kill you. They're gonna have to kill me too. Jesus goes, man, you're gonna deny me before the rooster crows. The drinking the cup in the garden is the ability to be arrested and hated and confronted by the evil person and not pull your sword. Peter's already proved he's not ready to drink that cup. And the denial shows he's not as well. But just because you're not ready doesn't mean you're not his child. Okay? Just because you fall down and mess this thing up. Because guess what? You know what the point of this story is? We're all going to warm our hands by a charcoal fire and say, I'm not him. We're all going to face an enemy and pull a sword and cut his ear off. Not literally, hopefully. God, maybe, but not literally. But we're all guilty of cutting off people's ears from being able to hear the truth because of the way we treated them or the way we respond. That's the point of that story, because of the way we responded. We've all warmed our hands outside while the real action's going on the inside, staying as far away from the stuff as we can, trying to hide behind the curtain a little bit so that we don't have to get involved and make a decision and take a stand. And that when we do get confronted, it's just the I am not him. And we've all had to face off with the repercussions of the stuff we've done in this world where we should have been like citizens of the kingdom, but we acted like we didn't know the Lord. And then we're confronted by the violence and the retribution and the hatred and the unforgiveness of the world. And we're all going to face that. That's us standing next to the fire. The beauty of it is that it's not the end of our story, that we do get something else. Look at that verse again, 18:27. Peter denied again, and immediately the rooster crowed. And some of this is knowledge that we talked about way back in that lesson on when the rooster crowed. But I want to bring this back to your thought process. The rooster crowed as a fulfillment of prophecy. Jesus said it would. It's not because the rooster wouldn't have crowed without the prophecy. But the only reason you bring up the rooster crowing, you don't bring up the rooster. We've never seen that before. Jesus and his disciples spent the night in the desert. And then the rooster crowed. And then they got up and made ham and eggs. They probably wouldn't have had ham, but it's not quite the new covenant yet. Did you catch that? If he did, he was really in the new covenant, wasn't he? He goes, this is what you get to eat after I die. Anyway, where was I going with that? Oh, the point that the Bible doesn't just give you the rooster crowing as a timing mechanism, but as a fulfillment of prophetic mechanisms. It's the only reason you throw that in. So it's a fulfillment of prophecy, but it also crows to announce a new day because the rooster doesn't crow in the middle of the night. So the analogy there is the sun's coming up, that there's a brightness, there's a future. In the darkest night of your soul, there is still hope for tomorrow. Because what Jesus told Peter was that the rooster was going to crow. In other words, there's going to be a new day. Let not your heart be troubled. Here's the future I have for you. Here's the plans that I have for you. So there's still hope for tomorrow. The other Gospels mention the rooster. Those other Gospels all tell you that the rooster crowed. They all hang Peter out to dry. And John looks like he's going to join him. In fact, John's version of the story is worse than the others, man. He's really hyped it up. He's doing this whole side camera shot. He's following Peter while he's following Jesus. And he's introducing characters we never heard of, like the relative from the garden is in the story now. I mean, Peter's really in it deep. And it would be a tragedy if John does this to Peter. He hangs him out like no other gospel, but John doesn't. In fact, John is the only one to include the redemption of Peter. And it sounds a little bit like this. I'll pick up a few of the verses deeper into the story. But in the post-resurrection world, Peter decides to go fishing. We'll have a lot of fun when we get there in John 21. But this is the preview. Peter decides to go fishing. And a bunch of his friends join him. And they toil all night trying to fish. And as the day breaks and the rooster crows somewhere way off in the distance, I like to imagine that happens. Because you can hear really well over the water. And about the time the rooster crows way off in the distance, he sees a silhouette standing on the beach. The man says, have you caught any fish? And he goes, no, we've been toiling all night. All night. It's been a dark night. There's nothing. And the man on the shore goes, cast your nets over to the other side. Peter has this faint sound. He heard that 3.5 years ago. And in that version, he saw very clearly a man he had never met before, walked onto the deck of his boat and said, have you caught any fish? And he goes, no, cast your nets over on the other side. And he did. And he brought in so many fish, his nets began to break. And he remembers that on that day, he fell down at that stranger's feet and he repented of all of his sins. Nobody preached the gospel to him. He didn't have to. Because the goodness of God leads men to repent. And in that moment, Peter sold everything he had. His name, his fortune, his reputation. To go follow that carpenter. Because something happened in his soul. So he hears that faint sound of that in his head. Throw your nets on the other side. And so inexplicably, he does it. And I think the whole time he's doing it, he's watching that silhouette. Because something feels so strange. Something so real about this moment. And the nets begin to tremble on the edge of the boat. And I don't know that Peter even waits. I don't think he has to because the sound of those fish jumping, it's replayed over in his head again. You don't get this chance, but once in your life, for someone to walk into your life and tell you to cast your nets on the other side, And then it was like my whole life started. And the last 3.5 years, it's a blur. I walked on the water. He fed the hungry. We raised the dead. A man doesn't get that 2 times in his life. He only gets to do that once. And if he blows it, he's done. That's the way it works. And he jumps out of the boat because you can't believe that maybe, if this is who I think it is, maybe you really do get that chance twice. And he swims to the shore. John 21:9. As soon as they got to the land, they saw, and John uses this phrase in the Greek, a charcoal fire. He brings it back from 3 chapters early. He's the only writer in the New Testament that does it. And he's the only gospel writer that bothers, because he can't leave Peter standing there dying at a fire. He brings the fire back. He just moves it to the beach. And he takes Jesus out of the courtyard and he puts him right next to it. And there's fish laid on it and there's bread. And Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you just caught. 11. Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not broken. We'll have so much fun with that, because the first time the net broke, but the last time the net doesn't break. And there's a reason for that. But that's chapter 21, and we're in chapter 18, so we can't go there. Verse 12, Jesus said to them, come and eat breakfast. Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? Knowing that it was the Lord. And I didn't want to read the whole thing, because I know me. And I know that I won't get out of it. So I just want you to know this. They stop and they have breakfast by a charcoal fire, because Jesus wants to give every opportunity for the reader. This isn't just for Peter. For the reader to know. You're going to face your fire and it's going to burn you up. And that's what's going to happen to you. But you're not done. Because Jesus always meets you right back there at that same place. Jesus invites Peter to dine. Come here, sit down, eat. That's the ultimate expression in Jewish lingo for we are good. It's why Zacchaeus' story is so beautiful. Zacchaeus is the chief tax collector. He's sitting up in a tree. Jesus walks by and goes, Zacchaeus, come down. We're going to eat lunch at your house today. And all the other people in town get mad at Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus didn't even do anything. He just climbed a tree because he was too short to see Jesus. And Jesus goes, come on down. We're going to eat at your house. Because by saying we're going to eat at your house, that's Jesus saying, we're good. I don't have any problems with you. Me and you. When Jesus says to Peter, come sit down over here next to me. I'm going to give you something to eat. Second chance. This is my moment. Peter denied Jesus 3 times. So guess what Jesus does in John 21? Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? It's not because Jesus isn't sure Peter loves him. It's because the redemptive power of Jesus is so great. He wants to take the trifold failure of Peter at the charcoal fire. He wants to put him by a new charcoal fire, and he wants to give him 3 chances to succeed. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Peter passes every one of them, because this is a redemption story. Because you are changed, comma, by a fire. And you are also changed by fire. You literally become someone new. You have a transformative moment. You have a transformative process. When we meet Jesus by the fire, we're not exposed. Not when we meet Jesus. When we stand and warm our hands by the charcoal fire of this world, we are exposed for who we are. Deniers. Weak. Murderous. Backbiters. Boasters. Proud. Lovers of self. Envious. Lusts of the flesh. But when we meet Jesus by charcoal fire, he doesn't expose us. He transforms us. He gives us a second chance. It's not that we need to run from the fire, so we need to run to the right fire. Now, this is what's so awesome. The biblical narrative of the fire is doing this great thing that I showed you, those Old Testament examples. Then you get up here to Peter and he has his dark moment, but then he has his bright moment. I think there's another pretty cool one, and I just want to share one more real quick story, and then we're going to come back to Peter. But remember this one from Acts 28, verse 1. Paul and his companions, when they had escaped, they found out that the island they were on is called Malta. And the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. Verse 4. So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man's a murderer whom, though he escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow him to live." That's a pretty good conclusion. You go, my gosh, dude's shipwrecked, gets to the land, viper jumps out, he's supposed to die. You know, it's like you survive a plane crash, and then on your way to the hospital, somebody hits the ambulance and kills you. You go, you're supposed to die. That plane was supposed to get you. You know, that's just the way it goes. But he shook off the creature into the fire, and he suffered no harm. Now, there's a turn. However, they were expecting he'd swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. And in the next verse, he begins to heal people on that island. It brings a great revival as we start to head out to the end of the book of Acts. The reason I wanted to point that out is because I think it's just this one little parting shot in the New Covenant that kind of shows you the progression of our experience with the fire. I don't think we have to fail there. There's redemption when we fail. I don't think we have to fail there. I think the fire's out to get you sometimes, and there's a snake attached. This is like all of the negative archetypes thrown into one, and yet Paul shakes it off because that's our destiny. We're not destined to die at the hand of the snake. We are not supposed to die at the hand of the dragon. The fire is not supposed to kill us. We are more than conquerors through him that loved us. It's as if the Bible wanted to give you that one more story. But I want to close with you thinking about Peter, this guy who is changed by the fire, so transformed that something happens to him. Think of it this way. Peter at Pentecost. Peter at Pentecost is touched by a brand new fire. The Bible tells you in Acts 2 that the Holy Spirit fell with cloven tongues like as a fire and sat on each and every one of them. Peter's next encounter with the fire is Pentecost. And it transforms him into a bold voice for the kingdom. This fire takes the sword out of his hand. There's never another biblical moment where Peter responds with violence. And it puts the sword in his mouth. Man, I've talked to you about that a lot lately. It takes the sword out of his hand and it puts the sword in his mouth. And what does he do with the sword in his mouth now that he's touched by a new fire? He leads 3,000 people to Christ, and he becomes the first voice in the Bible to the Gentiles. That's good news. The fire cannot harm what has already been burned. I think when we realize, first of all, we realize that Peter gets a new fire, and the sword stops to become a means of violence and starts to become a means by which people's lives are changed. Peter's a transformed man. The Peter in the book of Acts is not the Peter that warms his hands by the charcoal fire. That fire exposed him. The Peter in the book of Acts is the Peter that had breakfast with Jesus by a charcoal fire and then met the fire of the Holy Spirit and said, "I'm not the same man." That's a transformative fire. That's the fire of the Spirit we need in this hour in the church. And that's a transformative fire that takes it out of our hand and puts it in our mouth to transform people. That last phrase, "the fire cannot harm what has already been burned," comes from the thoughts on fire, on surviving a wildfire. There's actually something called the fire safety zone. One of the tricks of surviving a wildfire is to burn out a patch of ground and then stand in the middle of it. Because once the wildfire is coming at you, this is why one of the survival things you need is always a match or a way to light a fire. And that is not just so you can build a fire to eat food. It is in case you get caught in a wildfire, set the ground on fire and step across the fire line. Because fire cannot burn the same product two times. So the wildfire comes at you and it cannot burn where you stand. And there's something to me so spiritually true about that. That whatever has been burned up and taken out, you're safe from that. The Holy Spirit has put you in a safety zone. So let the old stuff, the experiences you had, let them provide you with the material you need to move forward. Instead of regret and embarrassment, step across that fire line and go, "You know what I'm going to use this for? It's going to protect me from the next fire. I'm going to remember this." I think Peter never forgot warming his hands by charcoal fire. Never forgot it. But he stepped across that fire line and he walked right back in next to a charcoal fire. And I think God needs some people that have faced the fire and realizes that we may get knocked down, but we cannot be destroyed. And how important that is. I've looked so forward to this lesson on Peter because it's us, man. It's me, it's you. It may be not today, maybe not tomorrow, hopefully not ever, but you know it's been you. I mean, let's be honest. If we're being honest, it's us. But the beauty of that second chance of that Jesus by the shore and eating next to him in that fire, and the beauty of that Pentecostal fire that takes that vengeance from my hand and puts the sword in my mouth. What a moment. What a moment. You've been changed by the fire. You'll be changed standing next to a fire. Let's get as close as to that as we can. That's not Pentecostal emotionalism. That's an encounter with the fan that's in the hand of the man, Jesus, who lives inside of you. Just let him blow over the chaff of your life. Just get rid of the junk I don't need. We ought to be praying that all the time. Father, just get rid of the junk I don't need. I don't have to bring sins in front of you to confess. You know everything about me. Father, help me take my hands off the chaff in my life. The junk. Let me put it in that safety zone. Let me just burn that up. And then I can be able to stand right there and rest. Next week, we go with Jesus into the trial. I know we opened with him there tonight, but I hope you understand why I had to do this little... Because there's no way we could do both of those stories in the same lesson. And the trial's going to take us long enough because there's so much good material between the Annas house, the Caiaphas house, the Herod house, the Pilate house, all the stuff we've got to deal with. I don't know that we can get through it in 1 week, but we're going to give it a good shot next week, all right? Father, I thank you for tonight. And this, what I felt was such a beautiful revelation of the redemptive power of Jesus. I feel like you manifested yourself in this room tonight through the stories of your redemptive power. And I feel like I can smell that charcoal of the fire on the beach that you've made for me more than once to say, hey, it's not over with. Here's another chance. And I don't think you have a limit to how many times you'll eat breakfast with me. And I thank you for that. And let us all have that revelation. That's a beautiful place. Changed by a fire. In Jesus' name.